Welcome to Yavna, and in particular to the Yavna OU Parenting Night. I'm Elaine Weisfeld, and I'm the General Studies Associate Principal here, grades 1 through 5. A part of my Yavna family is here, and those of you who are not part of our family, welcome as well. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce Dr. Judith Siegel, who is an associate professor at the Silver School of Social Work at NYU. She is a marriage and family therapist and has her own practice. She's the author of numerous articles and 3 books. The latest one is...
My fourth book.
Okay, the fourth book, which is really the topic of our discussion tonight, Stop Overreacting, Effective Strategies for Calming Your Emotions, or tonight, Reacting Calmly to Our Children. She's conducted numerous professional workshops and has appeared on Good Morning America and the Today Show. It's my pleasure to have you up here.
Well, thank you very much for the warm welcome. I passed around a handout. I always think that if you want to jot down notes, I didn't give you very much space to jot down notes, but you could make arrows and turn it over and jot some down there. I'm very excited to be here. I've been researching this book, the one that's coming out. Actually, the galleys are just going back to the editor. And I'm so excited by what I've been learning. So what I'm going to share with you tonight is a lot of the research that I've uncovered, which I only wish I knew when my children were your children's ages. So tonight we're going to talk about 2 things. We're going to talk about what happens when they're overreacting and what they need and how you can really use yourself as a parent in a very thoughtful and very important way. And then we'll talk a little bit, maybe there'll be less time, but we'll see how it goes, into how do you handle your own overreactions, especially around parenting. So tonight, I hope it's not going to be boring. The research interested me, but if I see people falling asleep, I'll just... So we're going to try out a PowerPoint, too. I don't know what people are going to find interesting or not. So first of all, let me start by saying, you know, we're going to define what is an overreaction. Now, if I say, what is an overreaction? Most people, the first thing they think about is a meltdown, right? So if I say, well, you know, if your kids are overreacting, what does that look like? And you might say, let's see if this works, that. Right? They start throwing things, they start screaming, they start, right? It's kind of ugly and it's very out there. But in fact, that's one style. So I, and of course other people, have called this an exploder. So one thing you can do when you're overreacting is to let it out, let it go, explode, and out it comes. And so that's the meltdown when people start thinking, oh, that's... But that isn't really how I look at overreactions. That is not how I am going to define it to you tonight so that you can really understand what is an overreaction. Because another style of managing emotions, emotional reactions that are unprocessed, so you've got the first clue here, they're unprocessed emotional responses. Another style, this isn't anyone's son, is it? Another style is that. Right? So sometimes the intense feelings that you have, the intense emotions, are not necessarily shown by throwing things, screaming, but they're experienced, right? And what might that emotional experience be? You've never felt like that? Frustrated, overwhelmed. We're friends, you can, you know, talk.
Upset,
okay. And what's this one? What's that? Yeah, oh, right? But her experience, is there anybody here who doesn't think that she's really unhappy, right? So there's something here about the intensity and the process, but she's imploding. Just like the exploder lets it out, An imploder holds it in. They hold it in, and in fact, they sometimes shut down. Some of your children, right? Because these styles happen by the time they're 5, 6, 7, or 8. They've already got their styles. Sometimes children just shut down, tune it out, and they have even less. Come in, there's plenty of room. Even less of a clue. And if they shut down, what does that look like? A shutdown might be just a pulling away, a pulling back from. So a child might be having a very difficult time, and other people are saying, oh, they're shy. They're not shy. They're just overwhelmed. And they're pulling back, right? It's all whatever that turmoil is going inside. They're imploding. And our last imploder is that little guy. So what is an overreaction, right? Now we're thinking, well, some people explode, some people implode. What is it? First of all, there's three ingredients. The first one is a trigger. Something triggers a reaction. So if it was a snake, right? If all of a sudden there was an insect or something flying around the room, we all might have a response to that. But in fact, life and how we develop a meaning is very complicated. So what you decide is actually a source of great discomfort might be different than the person sitting next to you or behind you. So there's some subjectivity in what that trigger is. But we're going to talk about some common things, especially for children your children's age. So we have a trigger and we have an emotion. An emotion is not a feeling. I didn't know that till I started researching. I used to use them indiscriminately. An emotion is emotional, like feelings, emotion. But it's not. An emotion is actually physiological. And I'll show you that in a minute. So something has to happen before what we're experiencing gets known to us as a feeling. And then I'll get into this in a minute, which we then further interpret. We give meaning. I'm excited about this stuff because it's brand new. It's brand new. George Bush, the first George Bush, gave a lot of money because he couldn't do space. Space was already done. So he did the brain. He gave a tremendous amount of money to neuropsychologists, neurobiologists, neurochemists who wanted to study the brain, and therapists who were very interested in figuring out, who are we? Why are we? Is it the nature, nurture? How does all of that work? So we have now generations of studies that were over the last decade, and most of this stuff, you can go to conferences, but these are, you know, brain doctors, so a lot of this is very dense and difficult to get through, and yet it's so pertinent to parenting. If I told you were going to have a class in neuroanatomy, you wouldn't have come. You would have gone to 301 or gone to stay in the cookies. But you don't have to memorize this stuff. But this is interesting. I could stay all night on this one, and this is going to be boring to you, and you're going to say next, and I'll say next slide. But now what they know is that there are different spheres in the brain. There's the right hemisphere, and there's the left hemisphere. What happens when we have an overreaction is that the amygdala, which is in the right hemisphere, gets excited. So if you were in a lab and they had a CAT scan or a PET scan attached to you, right, and they did something or said something that got you emotionally charged, your amygdala would light up and start firing. Now what's interesting is that the left part of the brain, which controls and manages the logic part of us, come on in, lots of room, you're welcome to come in, doesn't develop at the same rate. And you know that, right? Because when your kids were born, they could cry, but they couldn't talk, right? So, and for a long time, right, without words, it was all about emotions. The right brain is actually a very, well, okay, we're not going to go into that. What is interesting and important for you as parents is to understand that it isn't just about how the right brain develops or how the left brain develops. It's how the neural circuits between them develop. Have any of you read Dan Siegel or heard of Dan Siegel? Well, I didn't put a reference book, but that's the only book that I know that's out right now that would be, you know, very useful in terms of explaining the mind and the brain. But what we're looking at is the pathways between the amygdala, how it gets all excited, right, and the left part of the brain, which adds meaning and clarity. In other words, you can learn something. You can learn what to do the next time you have a meltdown. But if you're in your right brain and it doesn't connect to the left brain, you can't use it. Later, when you're calm and your amygdala's calmed down, you can remember it. Oh, I should have. But in the moment, you can't. So what we want to do is think about your goal as parents, and right now is when their left brain is catching up to their right brain. Right? So you're right at the cusp. Right now, their language and their ability to tell you, right, is catching up with their right brain. So what is your goal as parents? Your goal is, I have the privilege, I have the opportunity of creating a generation, my offspring, who have good circuits. So the saying that they have, I can't remember what I have, oh, you can't read all of that, but neurons that fire together, wire together. And the analogy I use for this is, let's say that you had a beach house, right? And it was maybe 300 yards to the beach. But it wasn't really, there was no path. So what you had to do, you wanted to go to the beach. So you would start. But you would sort of go this way and that way, and you see, oh, a patch of poison ivy, or, oh, there were a bunch of rocks that you couldn't get through. So you'd find your way down, right? The next time, you might remember that, oh, yeah, you don't go that way because that's where the ivy was, or you're welcome to come in. Don't go that way, that's where the rocks are. So now you get there more easily. Before, it took you 20 minutes to get there because you had to go back and forth. Now you get there in 10 minutes. And then you invite all your friends to come with you. Oh, well, now there's a big path, right? Because they've stamped on things. So that's what happens between the right brain and the left brain. When you start using it, when the connections are made, right, they're there for life. The good news is that you never are too old. So everything that you're going to learn tonight for your children, you can start applying for yourself. But this is their time. This is their moment to develop it. And you have a gift of being able to help provide that to them now, right? So this is powerful information, I hope. All right. So what I'm going to say is that an overreaction involves the mind and the body. And I'm probably speaking out of order here, so I'll change the slides another time. What we're thinking about is that when the amygdala gets excited, it creates a chemical change, right? There are seven or eight different things that are released, but I guess if you look at the most important one, probably are the cortical steroids. What that means is that your body's being primed for flight or fight. In other words, you get very, what John Gottman calls, you go into a state of high arousal, right? You're really, but in all of the studies that John Gottman did with people who were in that state, they're not able to attend to new information. So when you're in that state, you can feel it in your body. That's very important, by the way. When people are about to overreact, right, I'm going to say in a minute that you can't trust what you're thinking. Right, your amygdala is doing this number and it's not connecting to the left brain, or you wouldn't be overreacting. But your body is starting to take on what the messages and the changes that the amygdala is producing. So you're going to go into a state, and there's variations, but not so many variations. You're going to go into a state of high arousal. Your child goes into a state of high arousal. Right, so that their heart's beating. You can see some of them, their faces might get flushed. They might carry tension in different parts of their body. But it's that's one of the signals that you're getting ready to overreact. Your amygdala is already getting very excited. Okay? So it's body and mind, and it's past and present. And this is maybe more important for you as adults, because I said there were three ingredients to an overreaction: the trigger, the amygdala and physical response, and then the meaning that we assign. Now, your children still have belief systems. They're very, in the formative stages. Ours are a little bit more kind of further along. But what we believe is going to happen next, expectations are all carried on what psychologists call schemas. Is this getting technical and boring a little bit? I'll move it along. Okay. All right. So I'll get back to the idea of schemas when we look at ours, but let's for a moment think about the triggers for our children, right? The research has shown so many of these triggers were just so interesting for me to study, and I don't think that this is an all-inclusive list, but tonight I wanted to talk about two things that your children are facing as triggers, right? So one of them is rejection. The studies that they've shown, when they've got people that, you know, it's not really fair how they do these experiments anyway. They take psych students, undergrad, and they say, do you want to do a midterm or an experiment? Right? So they all run to the lab, right? And then they've got them all hooked up, and they do very terrible things to them, right? They have all these terrible studies, but I think the kids think they're, you know, hey, look at me, I don't have to do this exam. They wire them up, and they involve them in experiments where they're rejected. Do you know that the part of the brain that holds up, that gets activated when a person is experiencing rejection, is right next to and crossing over the part that feels pain? So if any of you have ever gone through a situation where you're rejected and you say, I felt like I was punched in the stomach, you did. It's painful. Rejection is painful. And then, you know, they can speculate, well, why is that so? These things are hardwired into us. And, you know, you can imagine that as a species, right, human beings needed to stay together in groups. That we were too powerless to really survive. So perhaps, this is all speculation, perhaps they wanted it to be painful so that you would learn from it, so that you would not do the same thing that got you rejected again, that you would try to, you know, modify your behavior so you could survive. But for your kid, all you need to know is that it's almost impossible to pass through childhood without being rejected. And the best of schools, and I'm going to, you know, our educators can contribute to this too. School is a place where children are going to learn how to survive socially without you. You've given them a lot, you've protected them a lot, you've enabled them a lot, you've empowered them a lot, and then you drop them off or you let them go into the bus and you say goodbye, and they're all yours. And maybe not so much in the classroom, sometimes in the classroom, but at the cafeteria or afterwards, who gets invited to whose parties, who's cool, who's not cool. It starts younger and younger. These used to be high school dilemmas. Now then they were middle school dilemmas. How many of you have kids who are 10, 11 years old? Tell me that they're not being triggered by rejection, right? Even younger, being excluded, not being invited to play. So rejection is painful, always. It ignites the amygdala, always. Well, we'll go through the triggers, and then we can talk about, well, how do we help them, right? What do we do? Criticism. Now, none of us are probably ever very good at it, right? It also is uncomfortable to get criticized. Criticism is not easy to take, although I have to say that a lot of what people hear as criticism, and we'll talk about this for parenting, you know, like in the second part, but sometimes it's feedback. Sometimes people are saying, I'm changing. Can you change? Because I don't like that anymore. I used to like it, but I don't like it anymore. Can you change? But it's being heard as criticism. Sometimes criticism is nasty because it's really about social standing. Right? So, and sometimes criticism and rejection go hand in hand. Sometimes kids can say, oh, you're lousy at that. You're lousy at that. You can't even dribble the ball. You want to play basketball? Right? So in that example, that's both a little bit of criticism and a little bit of rejection. But it hurts, right? And that's another experience that your kids are going to have. They're not going to get through childhood without it. Somebody is going to say something about the way they're dressed or the way they... Come on in. There's room. Welcome. And it's a trigger. So at all ages, it's a trigger. And envy. I had so much fun researching envy. A lot of people don't know very much about it, except that it seems to exist in all societies and all cultures. And it has a danger, right? Like poo-poo and... Like we don't. If someone gives you a compliment, you don't really want to do it. And some people really go out of their way to minimize things. Why? Because they don't want envy, right? Envy can be destructive. There's a feeling that if someone envies you, they can wish something bad on you. Right? Many cultures have this. So envy is so frowned upon that we don't really give ourselves a chance to think about it and whether or not it exists or you know how it affects people. But when someone experiences envy, there's often an aggressive urge, and you see this with your kids, right? Sibling rivalry. What's all that about? Fighting over the biggest piece of the cake, right? We're fighting about who gets to watch. What is all that about? The envy, right, is wanting your attention, wanting you to choose them, wanting to know that they are the most important thing, and being jealous when they think their sibling is getting more. Or in school, right, that someone else is getting a privilege or something or an opportunity to do something that they're not. And when do our children develop moral guides? Because you've got kids, what, that are six, seven? How are they doing? Some days better than others, some situations better than others. There's a difference between having an external person there to say, don't do this, stop doing that, don't bite your brother, right? That's an external. But internally, do you see your children starting to kind of like weigh things and have a temptation to do something and then correcting that? You know, it's some days it's better than others, but this is when five, not so good, right? It's more about getting caught. Who's looking? It's okay. Take the cookie. No one will see. But it's an interesting. This is a whole other different lecture, right? About how kids mature. But until they have the inner moral guides, right? They're left alone with aggression in their envy. And that's very uncomfortable, and they're not supposed to talk about it. Some of the sibling rivalry that you see when they start really being nasty to each other is really about that. Their amygdala is very excited, and there's a lot of reactivity, but there's no words to it yet. There's no left brain, right brain connection. Let's see what I have here. All right. Can you see this?
No.
All right. Well, see if I remember it. All right, so now, the next time your child's acting up, right, I want you to imagine that you have a CAT scan, right? So remember the picture of the brain? You know, their amygdala lighting up, bright, bright. Their amygdala is lighting up. What do we want to do? Remember the path? Going to the beach house. We know that if we can help them develop the circuits, then it's for life. We've really made a huge difference in their capacity to, well, many things, but for starters, to be able to calm themselves down and to be able to learn how to stop overreacting. So, what do we do? And we'll talk about this in a minute, too. The most important thing is you have to be calm. The right brain, the amygdala, being excited in your child, is actually contagious, if you didn't know that already. So you could be calm, cooking, having a little whatever, relaxing, the music, and then they start fighting, and then you walk into this intensity, and if you had the CAT scan on, right, we can have a portable CAT scan, your amygdala just lit up. So what we have to do is try to remember that what we need to do is create calm and connection. Calm and connection. What we're going to try to do is figure out how we can help these pathways develop. It can only happen in calm and connection. So if we want to touch our child, if we want to hold our child, if we want to be able to put our hand on them, we use a soft voice, right? We find our own calm. and we bring that to the situation. So that's really important. When they have these poor psych students who thought they were getting out of their midterm, and they get them all aroused, do you know that learning to name a feeling snaps the amygdala like that? Stops it in its track. Isn't that interesting? What is a feeling? A feeling is when you have the capacity to observe your state. You have reflection. They have charts, I don't know if you have them in the school, with the smiley faces and maybe 40, 50 different feelings. Right? It's amazing. We never got them. Did any of you ever get any of those? They've got such great things for kids right now. Get your kid to bring one home, and you'll be amazed at all these amazing feelings that you never knew you had before. But the ability to reflect on your state takes you out of your amygdala into what? Where is observing? It's in the left brain. The minute you've asked, what am I feeling? You're in your left brain. The capacity to know someone else's feelings, the perception, and the ability to decipher that information is in the left brain. If your child is all excited, right? But you want them for in life to know how to do this, to be attuned to someone else, attunement, left brain, right? So you want them to be able to reflect and notice and make sense of information that other people may be in a different emotional state or what they're saying or how they're feeling, all from the connections, left brain, right brain, all that beautiful pathwork, the neural network that we're trying to create, neurons that fire together, wire together. That's the path. So you ask the child, calm, right, connection, and then maybe you have to start. You look like you're upset. Might be a beginning, right? But I am upset. Oh, and you're going to try to coax your children to find their feelings, to name their feelings. This is a beautiful gift that you can give a child, the opportunity to make that left brain, right brain, name their feeling. Huge. Okay. Now, I didn't get into the Pandora's box slide, and we're going to do that again for the adults, trying to make sense of our Pandora's boxes. But your kids have them too. Your children have their own Pandora boxes because they're attaching meaning to the event, but they haven't thought it through. So remember my three ingredients of an overreaction? It's unprocessed. The comprehension isn't there. They've assigned meaning. It's dangerous. This is what they feel. It's raw. It's unprocessed. And boom, it's intense. Right? Whether they're exploding or imploding. Like that poor little girl with the sad face. Right? Something was clearly wrong. So our ability then is to help them understand the trigger. Well, we could start by what happened. But what does that mean to you? What does that mean to you? And if our child wants to talk about rejection, if our child wants to talk about criticism, if our child wants to talk about envy, let them. Let them try to tell you about the triggers, right? Because that's an important process. Just letting themselves be heard. By the way, this is also good for us as grown-ups. If you're having a fight and someone's out of control, this is the same recipe. Being able to ask someone what's wrong without judging it, without interrupting it, without minimizing it or defending it, or without telling them right away that they're wrong, right? Just allowing them to explain, because that's left brain, right brain, right? And they're diffusing the amygdala as they do this. So if we're not sure, we take our CAT scan, we put it on, right? Just testing, make sure. Okay, confront. That this is a teaching moment. Now, when their amygdala is all excited, it's not a good teaching moment. And do you know that? If they get their amygdalas all excited, and then you walk in and your amygdala is all excited, this is not a good teaching moment, right? We're thinking calm, connection. And then only then, an opportunity to start that left brain, right brain. And now, a teachable moment. What may be their beliefs that they have? You love him more than you love me. He always got this, he always got that, right? You love him more than... A teachable moment. So your ability then to say, you know, sometimes it feels like that. But when you're upset, and I'm going to get to this slide in a minute, you know, maybe you're only remembering all the times that he got things. Maybe you're not remembering the times that he didn't get something and you got it. So we have a teachable moment, an opportunity to take the meaning system and to bring in new information. This is also an opportunity for us to challenge. Well, what I was just talking about is splitting. And splitting is when we see things as all good or all bad, and very often, in my research anyway, that's the thing I'm probably the most interested in, is how the amygdala, right, and it excites our bodies, and what happens is we get certain defenses, and splitting is one of them, and if that happens, we're all sunk. That's when things get very, very bad, very, very, we only see things as...
I think I actually do have a slide.
Oh, I might have known. Well, if this is my, you're my guinea pigs, right? This is my first time using this PowerPoint. So in a minute, we'll find the slide, and then I'll say more about it. All right. So now I've given you a perfect, this is how you were the perfect parent, right? You don't get excited, and this is your goal. You're going to do calm, connection, and then you're going to get a teachable moment. You're going to try to help them challenge their beliefs. But we're not all perfect. Right? So sometimes our amygdala gets excited and we're overreacting. Contagious emotions. Right brain starts the right brain going. So that happens, right? And those poor psych students have demonstrated that. Wonderful, wonderful research studies about stuff like, and you know this, exhaustion. When you're tired, when your child is tired and hungry, that's when they're likely to have a meltdown, right? And when you're tired and hungry, that's when you're likely to have a meltdown. And the unhelpful defenses, I think I should go into them. This is the belief systems that can step in without your realizing it. You know, I tell people it's like you have a pair of glasses on. And sometimes you've got a pair of sunglasses on, and it makes everything perhaps more purple or dark, right? And you forget that you have them on. So you might be looking at the sky and go, oh, isn't that sky beautiful? And then someone says, why? Take off your glasses. It's actually kind of gray. And when you take your glasses off, you realize that, oh, yeah, the sky was gray, but it's how the sky looked when I had those glasses on. Right? The glasses changed the appearance. Sometimes our defenses are like that too. We start thinking about something, we're convinced of it, right? It's all good or it's all bad, and we're convinced of it, but in fact, it's just like we have a pair of glasses on. Sometimes with the adults that I work with, they say it's like someone, you're welcome to come in, I think, is there a chair in the back? Yeah, absolutely. There's one in the back, and two in the back. There's three in the back. Right. So, I wish if I have more time and you're interested in this, ask me about it, because it's really important for us. We don't stop splitting just because we're adults. It doesn't mean that we don't have these defense mechanisms. But when you're learning how to work with your children and you see that they're doing it, you know, you've got a very important opportunity. When we split, we have memories and experiences with the emotion, right? So something terrible happens to you, and you have very, very strong feelings about it, and you file it away. That was what I was telling you before. We file it away. Now, in splitting, you have an all-good drawer or an all-bad drawer. And this is what it looks like. You know, in a file cabinet, you can't open both drawers at the same time, right? So if you're in your all-bad drawer, something happens, your all-bad drawer opens up. You're going to try to take some experience that you've had and try to get meaning attached very quickly. We do this without asking ourselves to do it. It's an automatic way of comprehending life. The bad drawer's open. So what does that mean? There's a couple of things that are going to happen. One is that when that bad drawer's open, other memories, other situations that were just like that, very similar, can spring out. This is what happens when you fight with each other sometimes. You're annoyed. But then your mind starts to say, this is exactly like what you did last week and 2 years ago, and I've got older couples, 15 years ago you did this too, and I remember, and then they tell me the date, you know? So this is very precise, this memory. Why? Because it was filed away in the folder, and when a like event happens, it springs up. And remember my definition of overreaction. Body and mind, present and past. And that's how it happens, right? That's how it happens, because you've opened up that file cabinet. Unfortunately, and this is where you, when you're working with your child, they have no access to the good memories. You always give him everything he wants. But honey, I just got you a bicycle. Oh, like they forgot, because they're in their bad drawer. But they can tell you all the other times when he got something, right? Because they're in their bad drawer. Learning to be know when you're in your bad drawer, learning to understand that this is normal, especially for a child your children's age, this is normal. But helping them undo that, helping them close the drawer. I think you're being a little excited. You know how sometimes when you get excited, everything just looks like it's this way, all bad. But it isn't, honey. Just calm down, and we're going to try to remember some of the good times too. Let's try to balance it out. Now you... We're supposed to laugh at that one. I said, when do you overreact? Right? When you're overburdened. Right? When you're overburdened. Oh, you can't see this very well. That's you. That's your desk, and that's all the work that you haven't done. Right? So what can we be overburdened by? We can be overburdened by work. Or the house, right? What we have to do. Or there they go again. Right? So, now we're going to shift gears just a little bit. Sometimes it's hard to be there for our kids, right? Being a parent, it's the most beautiful job in the world, and I think it's the most difficult job in the world, right? It gets complicated sometimes. So, and I want to save time, you know, for questions too. And I know you can't read this all. I'm going to read this to you. Sometimes it's hard for us to stay objective and calm because we see ourselves in our child. Sometimes I have so many stories of this. You know, I had a mother, you know, putting her child on the bus for the first time, and she was like, oh, it's going to be terrible. How am I going to do this? Really working herself up. I had no reason to think the little girl was uncomfortable about it. I said, how do you know? Why do you think this? Because I remember when I went on the bus the first time, right? So sometimes we know our experience. We remember our experience, and we assume that our child will have that same experience, right? Not always so. So sometimes we see ourselves in our child, and that may make us too involved in one way, or sometimes even giving our anxiety to our child. And there's lots of stories. I work with so many parents with this. You know, if a child goes through a situation, and I'm telling you before, all children will go through rejection, criticism, and envy. They will not pass through childhood without it. But if your child comes home the first time that he or she is rejected, you know what you're going to start thinking about? Haven't thought about it in years. Forgot that it ever happened. And what are you going to start remembering? The time you were rejected. Right? The time you were rejected. Sometimes we overreact as parents because we see our partner in our child. That's a little bit of a funny sentence, right? But sometimes we work really hard to keep our marriage stable, and we accept things in our adult partner even though we wish we didn't have to. We don't love every part of our partner. We love most of the parts, and we try to remind ourselves of that, but we don't love every part of our partner, right? And what happens when the part that we hate the most, we're sitting there, and all of a sudden, there it is again, Junior, right? Sometimes we tend to overreact when we see that, right? Because it's loaded for us. when else do parents overreact? Parents can be fighting for control. And I see this so often. We're not going to talk about it all night. But, you know, when you think about, although I know that there's some people here that are divorce mediators, and some of you may have gone through a divorce, and you know people that have gone through a divorce or are thinking about going through a divorce, what do they fight about? The kids, right? They fight about the kids. The kids are the most precious resource in a family. But no two parents, I have yet to meet them. If you are like this, please introduce yourself to me at the end of my speech, because I'm always kind of hoping and thinking maybe one day I will meet them, that are actually clones of each other. That they really see just about everything when it comes to raising their child. They agree perfectly. So please, if you are like most of the people that I work with, it isn't always like that. And sometimes when parents are not able to feel like they're on the same page, right? They're really invested in dominating, in making sure that they win, that their way is what happens. So sometimes the child is in the middle of that. I think in the other thing I'm going to do tonight, we'll spend a little bit more time talking about parents and what goes on when they try to co-parent successfully. But just in a very short kind of one little blurb thing here, the idea of being different is good. That's a gift for your family and for your children. Because if one person is a little bit protective and cautious and the other one is a little bit adventuresome, that's a very good thing. It may not feel that way, right, in the middle of trying to make a decision. But I look at it as like people who are in a canoe together, right? You're in a canoe together. And if one person is taking a very strong position on one side, it really forces the partner to have to balance, right? Or else the boat's going to go over. And often that runs into a lot of problems around parenting and the child, right? So it's almost like if you see your partner doing what you think is an extreme position, you're forced to balance, then your partner experiences you as doing something in the opposite direction, they're forced to take the even stronger. It happens over discipline. You can tell me, it happens a lot, right, over a lot of things. But what we allow our children. And so that's sometimes when we're not really able to parent very calmly, because it's not about parenting, it's about the marriage. Sometimes we are triggered, right, because we're overreactive to a child's behavior, because we're worried about the community. We're worried about what other people are going to think about that, whether it's your parents or your in-laws or the teachers, right? Your daughter wants to wear her ballerina outfit to class. Come on. No one else has ever had a daughter that wanted to wear, or your son wants to wear, what do the little boys want to wear? Their Batman outfit, right? And part of you says, okay, what's the harm? And the other one goes, oh my gosh, right? What are the other parents going to say about me? And if I run into my mother-in-law, oh, what's she going to think? Or even at this age, I want to put a purple streak in my hair. You've got some of your kids 9, 10 years old, right? It happens very early. I want to put a purple streak in my hair. Oh, no, what are people going to think about me? So some of the things that we overreact about are about us being judged. And finally, this is a hard one to just kind of like deal with really quickly, but sometimes it's a good thing to worry about our kids. You know, you hear terrible stories a lot. Bad things can happen. It's a good thing to worry. But sometimes we worry too much, right? And why did I even put that on the board? I put that on the board because a right amygdala and anxiety is right there, right? You put your CAT scan on the minute you're worrying, and off goes the light. It's contagious. Before, we were looking at it by when your child is out of control, it can make you tense. Now think about it the other way. If you're anxious about something, do you not think your child knows that? Right? So that becomes another time when we have to be very thoughtful about our overreactions and their consequences. So I don't know if I have any more slides.
This is a surprise to me too.
Oh, I do. All right. Because I want to leave time for us to have some questions too, right? Things to consider. Little jewels. An incremental versus an entity approach is one of the biggest things that I read about that I thought is absolutely amazing in terms of people who tend to overreact and people who don't. A person who is an entity thinker, and I don't know if it's 50-50, we probably have a good many entity thinkers and some incremental thinkers, right? A person who is an entity thinker believes that people are the way they are, and you have to just, once you've made a judgment about a person, that's who they are. That's what you should expect, and that's who they are. So, if you walk in and you see that your son hasn't done his homework, right, and he wants to play games, and he hasn't done his homework, and his room is a mess, you might go like this. An entity thinker would say, my son is lazy, and it would be even worse. Remember, we talked about the emotional memories and stuff from your own past. If you came from a family where one of your siblings, for example, might have had that characteristic, you might say to yourself, he's lazy, just like my sister. And you know what? My sister, my parents poured money, tutors, the whole thing. And at the end of the day, she flunked out of college anyway. All that money down the drain. Because she was lazy. She was lazy as a kid, and she's still lazy now. And he's the same way. An entity thinker. An entity thinker will say, well, I think I'd like to learn how to knit. Right? And then they start, and they drop it. I'm no good at this. And they put it away. An entity thinker, right? And an entity thinker says, I'm either good at this or I'm not good at this. And if I'm good at this, I'm going to be very good at this. But things that I'm not good at, forget it. That's an entity thinker. An incremental thinker approaches the child very differently, and himself or herself. An incremental thinker knows that there are conditions and circumstances that make things different, and that people change in little pieces. And they grow in little pieces. They grow in increments. So, the father might notice that his son hasn't done his homework and he wants to play and his room's a mess. And he might say, is he lazy? Or he might say, I wonder why he's not doing his homework. And he might ask his son, you know, I know your homework isn't done. Why aren't you doing it? And it's stupid. Teacher's stupid. No offense. Right? And he could say, well, okay, maybe you didn't understand it. Why don't we look together? Just show me in the book. Show me in the book what you didn't understand. I don't want to. Just show me in the book what you didn't understand. And then after a few minutes, the little boy is going, oh, I get it. This is a piece of cake. And whips off the homework. Right? And the father could say, you know what? Because it was easier for him to avoid it. But when he has a little bit of help and he has a little bit of guidance and a little bit of support, he can manage step by step. An incremental thinker would start to knit and it would all come out funny and he'd laugh and he'd say, well, it can't get worse. It can't get worse. And try again. Because you believe that if you try again, you can get better. And it's a very interesting thing to see in life. How often we've become entity thinkers and how damaging that is to us, to our relationships, and to our children. So, being able to imagine that, you know, asking yourself, even in that moment, is there anything that I can do to approach this as an incremental thinker is huge. We're all going to overreact. And now, remember I showed you all those pictures of all the overreactors, and I said you've got the exploders, you've got the imploders. The exploder, you can say, oh, well, you did a lot of damage. As an adult, when you explode, what do? You scream, you threaten, you swear, say nasty things, throw things. I hope you don't do worse, right? But when we melt down, so you're thinking, okay, I guess I should take responsibility for that. That's the repair word. If you're an imploder, you're doing just as much distance. I mean, an imploder withdraws. You remove yourself from the situation. Right? That is just as destructive to a family or even in your work. When you implode, you become sour and cynical. That affects everybody around you. So when you think about it, taking the next step is to repair, because we're all going to lose it, we're all going to get overwhelmed. And teach your children this too. When you do damage, it's your responsibility to repair it. And being able to go up to the person and say, I think I haven't been handling this very well. I'm really sorry. It's just been whatever, right? An effort to repair is huge. It's again, it's teaching your child, I think, the moral code that you want. And for yourself, it's also, you know, an opportunity to mend relationships. If we're trying to keep this left brain, right brain thing going, you need connections, right? And also, it's one more thing in the bad drawer. If you repair it, it doesn't ever go in the bad drawer, right? It gets diffused, it gets resolved, right? But if we leave it after what we've done, it goes into the bad drawer. Seek support and affirmation. And remember all the overburdened parents that I saw? You know, your ability to seek support, and I've got so many interesting people that I've worked with, you know, their ideas about self-sufficiency and how the meaning that they've attached to needing help or needing anything. Well, think twice about the messages that we're sending our kids. Yes, it's good to be self-reliant, and being self-sufficient in certain circumstances is a wonderful feeling. But to grow up not being comfortable asking for help is not a good thing. It's a formula that you know you're going to end up overreacting because we can't do it alone. Seek support and seek affirmation. That also means group involvement, because I know when they've done all these studies again, and I'm sorry that we don't have the time, but when you have a goal that's in your occipital, right, and it's your left front of your brain, if you have a goal in mind, it actually exerts a presence over the amygdala. So being able to have a goal in mind and fresh in your mind prevents us from overreacting. It's very interesting. People who go to daily prayers, right? What are they doing in their daily prayers? They're connecting and they're affirming with who they want to be. They're keeping the goals of who they want to be fresh in their mind all day. It's a beautiful thing. So, and to challenge the patterns, which is more than we're going to get into. All right, so I can see I did a few slides out of order. I really do think that's it. Should we just see? No, I think that's it. But questions? Frank, do we have time for questions? Because we started with 5 minutes. That means we can have 5 questions if you speak very fast and I answer very fast, or we can have... Who's got a question? What do you think? Interesting stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Just a comment. In the booklet that you received when you came in, there are a number of articles on how to react fondly to your children. So it's some very specific advice. So these booklets are made for the purpose of enhancing the workshop that you are attending. And what I heard are a lot of similarities, tell me if I'm correct or incorrect, between a child and a husband and wife. Basically, the reaction to one another is similar to the way we react to our kids.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's, you know, the right brain, left brain, all over again, and even some of the themes are very much the same.
Hello, and again, welcome to tonight's program. The time now is approximately 8:30. Our first sessions will be concluding momentarily. Please join us for refreshments in the cafeteria. There will be an approximately 10-minute break before we start the second round of sessions. Enjoy your evening.
All right, well, again, if you were that couple that you see things the same way, please do stop and introduce yourself. Otherwise, it's been a pleasure. So I hope then that you enjoy the rest of the evening, and thank you for coming.